You're listening to the Life in Deep Ellum podcast, exploring the sacred in art, faith, and community.
Hey guys, here's a few announcements for you today. There's a couple of awesome, exciting things happening, and the first one is a voter registration drive-through that we're having on March 13th. This is for Dallas County voters only. Dallas has one of the lowest voter turnouts for municipal elections in the nation. I know, that sucks. So we hope that this voter registration drive-through helps you to participate in this year's election confidently and with all the information that you need. When is Election Day? It is May 1st. April 1st is the last day that you can register to vote, and April 19th through 24th is early voting. So May 1st is Election Day, okay? And if your voter registration information is incorrect, come to this drive-thru. You can check it. You can make sure it's correct. Just bring your ID, which you should have anyway because you're driving. And you'll also get, this is my favorite part, you'll also get to see information on a sheet of paper about who is on your ballot. It might be a city council member, a mayor, a school board election. You'll get to see who's on your ballot, who they are, and then you can go online and look them up and read more about them. Municipal elections are so important because these are the officials who are doing the work that affects us the most in our everyday lives. So drive through our parking lot on March 13th between 10 a.m. and 12 p.m. to pick up more information so that you're ready to make your vote count this year. Exciting! Okay. We also think that it's important to honor Women's History Month as best as we can this year. There's so many ways we could do this. We could focus on the mass amounts of incredible contributions that women have made to our society. We could do a number of things, but I got a small group of volunteers to work together to put video features together of some of our very own lied women. How exciting is that? We're going to put together these features of our live ladies who are inspiring us just by being them. We're going to get to ask them questions about what it means for them to be ladies. It'll be awesome. So keep an eye out on our social media platforms for these features. And even though it feels like a little tiny thing that you can do, celebrate these ladies by leaving comments on their posts and by reposting their incredible stories. It's really encouraging when we can do that. We'll be shooting out other fun ways on our socials that you can be involved in the celebration of women all throughout this month. So keep an eye out for that. Love you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Daniela Coates. My husband and I have been attending Life in Deep Ellum for about 9.5 years now, and we have 5 awesome kids. If you don't recognize me, you would probably recognize me with all of my little ducklings in a row. So I'm super honored to be sharing today on Job and continuing our series. So the book of Job is all about suffering. And I'm guessing that just about all of you have experienced this wilderness in your life. Just look at 2020 and what we've already experienced of 2021. And it won't take long to see. We're walking through a lot as individuals, as a faith community, as a country, the world. And maybe we don't feel like we need to give up something extra for Lent this season. Maybe we feel like we've already given up enough. And that's an okay place to be too. Lent has really come at what feels like the perfect time. Okay, so last week, Jeremy talked about Job's friends. Today, I'm going to be talking about Job's protests, his responses back to his friends, as well as his protests to God himself. So these 3 friends show up at the end of chapter 2, and Job continues dialoguing with them and with God until chapter 31. So these back and forth dialogues went on for 3 cycles. One of his friends would say something, Job would say something in response, the next friend would jump in, Job would respond. After Job's final response, a 4th friend actually shows up to give his 2 cents. And there's a really clear pattern that we see here. Job is having to defend himself to his friends. Reading the book of Job is almost like reading an emotionally charged social media post. I find myself a little bit annoyed for Job, right? The things that his friends are saying to him, the accusations, And then I'm laughing at Job's sarcasm back to them, then the back and the forth on the back and the forth. Job 2:13 tells us that his friends sat with him for 7 days and nights in silence. They were doing so well until they opened their mouths. And Jeremy talked about this last week as well. So let's just refresh. Job lost everything. He lost all of his possessions, his property, his wealth. He lost his children, and he lost his own health. And here his friends are. And you know what the basic message is that they're giving him? Hey, Job, you brought this on yourself, man. God only punishes the wicked. So this must be a result of something you did. Or your kids, they must have done something wrong, which is why they're not here anymore. Just admit it. Just admit it, Job. Wow. Some friends. Over and over, Job asserts himself. He insists that the suffering isn't due to his own actions. I love his sarcasm. Here are some examples of his responses to his friends. Jeremy mentioned one of these last week as well. In Job chapter 12, verses 2 to 3, he says, "No doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. But I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you." Or Job 13:5, "Oh, that you would keep silent and it would be your wisdom." Or in Job 16:2, "Miserable comforters are you all." With every round, his friends come back at him, insisting that he's wrong. Though his friends are physically present, they are anything but empathic. And this brings me to my first point. There is loneliness in suffering. This probably doesn't seem like the greatest revelation. We already know that suffering is lonely. When we experience a great loss, there's only so much someone else can do to alleviate the pain that we're feeling. Being present is great, sure. But suffering often makes us feel like we're the only ones experiencing this. Chris mentioned it a couple weeks ago, but when we try desperately to find someone to blame or something to blame for our suffering, we can be left feeling even more lonely. We might be met with friends who don't understand or who don't care to understand what it is that we're going through. Even when we do feel supported by others, we still ultimately are left with the fact that it is us. It is me. It is my heart, my mind. I have to walk this journey. No one can do that for me. And this can feel terribly lonely. Jesus knew what this was like. Before his crucifixion, he's in the Garden of Gethsemane to pray, and he asks his closest friends to be there with him. He asked them to stay awake with him. But they were super tired, and they kept falling back asleep. And there Jesus is, left alone with God. None of his earthly friends there for him when he could have used their support. On the cross, Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Even though he anticipated his crucifixion, his suffering, Jesus still felt that loneliness, that abandonment, even from, and especially from God. Hebrews 2:18 tells us, "Since he, Jesus himself, has gone through suffering and testing, he is able to help us when we are being tested." Even when the loneliness of suffering is more than we can bear, we have a God who can truly understand our suffering. Let me tell you a story that you're probably already familiar with. It's from the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks. So this guy, played by Tom Hanks, gets stranded on an island for 4 years, all by himself. And there's this Wilson volleyball, and through a series of events, he ends up making a face on the volleyball with his own blood in his hand, and it becomes known as Wilson. He talks to it, he argues with it, he ends up throwing it and almost loses it at one point. Eventually, when he's rowing off the island on a raft, he ties Wilson, the volleyball, down to that raft and brings it with him. So he's leaving the island. The waves are smacking him. He's rowing. It's really physically exhausting. So eventually, he just passes out on the raft. And Wilson, the volleyball, slips into the water. When he realizes this, he jumps off the raft, grabs the rope so he's still attached to the raft in some way, and he begins to swim out to Wilson. He's dipping beneath the water. He's coming back up again. He's struggling. You could tell he's physically exhausted. But he's yelling, "Wilson! Wilson!" as he's trying to get to this volleyball. And eventually, he realizes it's just not going to happen. And he says, "I'm sorry, Wilson." And then he sobs. And he sobs. And he sobs. Suffering is lonely. And if a volleyball can make that much of an impact on a suffering man, imagine what the presence of a friend or God would do. Suffering allows us to better understand and empathize with the suffering of others. Notice I didn't say it automatically does make it so that we do understand what someone is going through or that we automatically empathize well, but it allows us this insight and this window. We get a picture of what another person might be feeling amidst this grief or this loss. Think of a time when you experienced deep pain. Maybe that's now. What did you need at that time? Maybe a listening ear. Maybe you just needed some space. Maybe dinner on a random night of the week. Maybe someone to help with bills, someone to advocate or fight for you. Maybe you just needed someone to acknowledge that what happened was unjust or unfair or simply painful. How can we use our experiences, what we know of suffering, to help others? If suffering is lonely, how can I help another in that loneliness? Point two, there is mystery in suffering. A few weeks ago, Gina talked about grief and leaning into that grief. And throughout the Bible, we see lamenting and spending time in that grief. That's okay. And I'm not going to focus heavily on grief itself since Gina did a fabulous job. What we see from Job is that there's this mystery that comes along with suffering. He can't give an answer to his friends for why this is happening to him, but he knows that it's not because of something he's done. He doesn't know why this has happened. And we continue to see him argue this point over and over and over throughout the book as well. At the end of his protest from chapters 29 to 31, we see Job basically arguing, "Look at all these good things I've done. What makes me deserve this, God? What is your problem?" So then there's the age-old question of suffering. What do we even do with it? Suffering doesn't always make sense. Sure, it can be a result of someone else's choices or even our own. It also doesn't necessarily have to have anyone to blame. And yet, no one is immune to suffering. No one is truly safe from it. And honestly, the Bible can be kind of confusing when it comes to this topic. If this was a concept that we as people really grasped and understood, then there wouldn't be hundreds of books written on the subject, including this poetic book of the Bible. No one quite understands the stance. All throughout the Bible, we see verses like these. Psalms 37:25, "I have never seen the righteous forsaken or his children begging for bread." Or Psalm 112, "Blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who greatly delights in his commandments. His offspring will be mighty in the land. The generation of the upright will be blessed. Wealth and riches are in his house, and his righteousness endures forever. For the righteous will never be moved. He will be remembered forever." Or Proverbs 3:33, "The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous." Verses like these seem to be in line with what Job's friends are saying. So does that mean that everyone who lost power a few weeks ago were wicked and being punished by God? I guess put me in that category. So those who never lost power for even a moment, those were the truly righteous? Sounds kind of ridiculous when we say it like that, doesn't it? In John chapter 9, Jesus heals a man born blind. And his disciples, the guys who are with him all the time, say, "Hey, Jesus, so this guy, is he blind because he sinned or because his parents sinned?" And Jesus says, "It's neither of those. Simply so that the works of God might be displayed in him." Okay, cool. So then how do we reconcile this with our own suffering? Just a bit ago, I read to you a couple verses from Psalm 112. But the next verse that follows is this. "He, the blessed man who fears God, is not afraid of bad news. His heart is firm, trusting in the Lord." So it seems that bad news is inevitable. We know that we live in an imperfect world full of imperfect people, but the Bible also gives us promise after promise of life. Look at Romans 8:28. It says, "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good." There's this mystery, this dance that we do with God and with suffering. We know that God is working somehow amidst suffering, yet it still doesn't always make sense. It doesn't make our wilderness feel any less lonely. Take a look at these verses, Romans 5, verses 3 through 5. "More than that, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And hope does not put us to shame." Travel back with me to the story of Joseph in Genesis. His brothers sold him into slavery because Joseph was his dad's favorite. Through a long chain of events, Joseph moves up to eventually becoming second in command of the land of Egypt, only after Pharaoh. At the very end of the book, at the end of the story, Joseph says to his brothers, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." Even Job says in chapter 23, verse 10, "But he knows the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come out as gold." But here's the thing. Job didn't get it either. In just 6 chapters, in Job 29, verses 19 and 21, this is now what Job is saying. "God has cast me into the mire, and I have become like dust and ashes. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. You lift me up in the wind. You make me ride on it, and you toss me about in the roar of the storm. For I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living." In one breath, Job is proclaiming his trust in God, and in the next, he's pointing a finger at God for the mess of his life. So where is God in all of this? What is he doing? Unfortunately, I don't have a great answer for you today. I'm not going to solve this age-old question. There's this mystery. The mystery in the story, in its unfolding. So, I have a story I want to share with you. It is from a guy named Max Licato. It's called Woodcutter's Wisdom. So it's like story time. Sit back and relax and listen to the story. "Once upon a time, there was an old man who lived in a tiny village. Although poor, he was envied by all, for he owned a beautiful horse. Even the king coveted his treasure. A horse like this had never been seen before. Such was its splendor, its majesty, its strength. People offered fabulous prices for the steed, but the old man always refused. 'This horse is not a horse to me, he's a friend.' The man was poor and the temptation was great, but he never sold the horse. One morning, he found that the horse was not in the stable. All the village came to see him. 'You old fool,' they scoffed. 'We told you that someone would steal your horse. We warned you that you would be robbed. You are so poor. How could you ever hope to protect such a valuable animal? It would have been better if you'd sold him. You could have gotten whatever price you wanted. No amount would have been too high. Now the horse is gone and you've been cursed with misfortune.' The old man responded, 'Don't speak too quickly. Say only that the horse is not in the stable. That's all we know. The rest is judgment. If I've been cursed or not, how can you know? How can you judge? The people contested. Don't make us out to be fools. We may not be philosophers, but great philosophy is not needed. The simple fact that your horse is gone is a curse. The old man spoke again. All I know is that the stable is empty, and the horse is gone. The rest, I don't know. Whether it be a blessing or a curse, I can't say. All we can see is a fragment. Who can say what will come next? The people of the village laughed. They thought that the man was crazy. He had always thought he was a fool. They had always thought that he was a fool. If he wasn't, he would have sold the horse and lived off the money. But instead, he was a poor woodcutter, an old man still cutting firewood and dragging it out of the forest and selling it. He lived hand to mouth in the misery of poverty. Now he'd proven that he was indeed a fool. After 15 days, the horse returned. He hadn't been stolen. He'd run away into the forest. Not only had he returned, but he'd brought a dozen wild horses with him. Once again, the village people gathered around the woodcutter and spoke. Old man, you were right, and we were wrong. What we thought was a curse was a blessing. Please forgive us. The man responded, once again, you go too far. Say only that the horse is back. State only that a dozen horses returned with him. But don't judge. How do you know if this is a blessing or not? I'm content with what I know. I'm not perturbed by what I don't. Maybe the old man is right, they said to one another. So they said little. But deep down, they knew he was wrong. They knew it was a blessing. 12 wild horses had returned with the one horse. With a little bit of work, the animals could be broken and trained and sold for much money. The old man had a son, an only son. The young man began to break the wild horses. After a few days, he fell from one of the horses and broke both his legs. Once again, the villagers gathered around the old man and cast their judgments. You were right, they said. You proved you were right. The dozen horses were not a blessing. They were a curse. Your only son has broken his legs, and now in your old age, you have no one to help you. Now you are poorer than ever. The old man spoke again. You people are obsessed with judging. Don't go so far. Say only that my son broke his legs. Who knows if this is a blessing or a curse? No one knows. We only have a fragment. Life comes in fragments. It so happened that a few weeks later, the country engaged in war in its neighboring country. All of the young men of the village were required to join the army. Only the son of the old man was excluded because he was injured. Once again, the people gathered around the old man, crying and screaming because their sons had been taken. There was little chance that they would return. You were right, old man, they wept. God knows you were right. This proves it. Your son's accident was a blessing. His legs may be broken, but at least he's with you. Our sons are gone forever. The old man spoke again. It is impossible to talk with you. You always draw conclusions. No one knows. Say only this. Your sons had to go to war, and mine did not. No one knows if it is a blessing or a curse. No one is wise enough to know. Only God knows. The old man was right. We only have a fragment. Life's mishaps and horrors are only a page out of a grand book. We're faced with suffering. We find ourselves in this wilderness. Now what? We will grieve. We will lament. We will cry and burst out in anger. We will point fingers. We will question God. And lastly, and most importantly, we will hope. Suffering's inevitable. We get to choose who we will be amidst this wilderness journey. Where will we look? This brings me to my third point. There is hope in suffering. Throughout his protest, Job is back and forth. He's despairing. He's irritated at his friends. He's hopeful. He's wondering why God isn't speaking up on his behalf. He says he wishes he'd never been born. Throughout his protest, Job is all over the place. While he protests with his friends throughout the book, he eventually takes it up with God himself. His final plea to God comes in chapter 31, verse 35. He says, "Let the Almighty answer me." He's grieving. He's gone through at least most of, if not all, of the stages of grief, round and around. I love my ESV study Bible. It says, throughout the dialogue in chapters 3 to 31, Job is essentially arguing God's character back to God from the belief that he is just. In doing so, Job the sufferer is structuring his lament as ultimately a posture of hope. What we see from Job is this. Trust in God's justice and character can sustain us. This doesn't mean we avoid despair. It doesn't mean that we avoid the feelings of pain. It doesn't mean that we understand what God is doing or how he's working. It doesn't mean that we even get back what we lost. But we trust that he is with us. We trust his goodness, his vantage point. I'm sure Marcel will talk about this more next week. All of us will face trials, temptations, and suffering throughout our lives. We'll come into short or long periods of this wilderness. Family struggles, rejection, abandonment, mental and physical illness, addiction, job loss, death of those we love, infertility, traumatic events, pandemics, winter storms. Now, I have an object lesson that I like to do. My dad was a children's pastor for most of my growing up, so I've seen my fair share of object lessons. Just remember, object lessons are intended to take a larger, more complex truth and turn it into something that's easier to understand, like for kids. So just as a little warning, there will be some loud noises involved in today's object lesson. So this right here is going to represent suffering. The suffering in our lives. And that's going to look different for all of us. I have two balloons. This balloon here represents people without hope. And I don't mean a temporary sense of the word, because I think all of us will have a tendency to lose hope somewhere along this wilderness. But I mean in a more permanent sense. Those without hope in God, that he will sustain us amidst the suffering. Someone going through suffering without this hope is going to feel the weight of every bit of that painful experience. They will crumble. It is just too much. This other balloon represent someone with faith in God to sustain them through the pain. You'll notice I have some water. I have some water in this balloon. This water can represent faith or hope, hope in God, hope in his character, hope in his love for us, hope in his wisdom and viewpoint. In fact, Jesus even told the woman at the well that he was the living water. So when faced with suffering, with our darkest days, those with hope in God can be sustained. Both of these balloons face the same pain, the same trial, the same suffering. But only one balloon came through. Once again, we see that Job continues to place himself in a posture of hope. He's grieving. He doesn't understand. He doesn't see a reason for this great loss and pain that he has experienced. And yet we do see him continually look to God. He knows that God is the source of wisdom. In Job 19, verses 25 to 26, he says, "For I know that my Redeemer lives, And at the last, he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh, I shall see God. The deepest, darkest moments of our lives don't have to be without hope. As people of faith, we can hold on to that faith and to that hope. This doesn't mean that we should avoid weeping. It doesn't mean that we avoid the feelings of grief or grief itself. This hope doesn't stop us from feeling the sting of our suffering. It doesn't lead us to stuffing our feelings or our pain. It doesn't mean we pretend like everything is okay when it's not. Even Jesus wept. He's about to heal his friend Lazarus, raise him from the dead, and he still weeps. Over and over, the Bible talks about Jesus being moved with compassion before he healed someone. Moved with compassion. If you have a hard time imagining Jesus with these emotions, I have a couple recommendations. First, check out the show The Chosen. They beautifully portray Jesus' humanness and emotions. Second, listen to this beautiful section from the Chronicles of Narnia, the magician's nephew. Diggory says, "But please, please, won't you, can't you give me something that will cure mother?" Up till then, he had been looking at the lion's great feet and the huge claws on them. Now in his despair, he looked up at his face. What he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life, for the tawny face was bent down near his own, and wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared with Diggory's own that, for a moment, he felt as if the lion might really be sorrier about his mother than he was himself. My son, said Aslan, I know. Grief is great. Earlier this week, my daughter Eden prayed and she said, thank you that Jesus died on the cross and we can be sad. We can be sad. We can be sad as we walk this wilderness. We can be sad on this Lenten journey. Even though we know joy is somewhere on the other side, we can be sad. Even though we know what comes on the third day, we can mourn the suffering that came before. There is one sure thing in this world, God. We may not always understand him. We may not be able to wrap our hearts and our minds around his being, but he is the realest, truest thing that we will ever encounter. When we don't know what to make of the things around us, happening to those we love, we can hold on to the hope of God. We can ask ourselves, what do I know is true of God? So I wonder if you might do a little exercise with me. What do you know is true of God? I'll give you a bit of time to think about this. As you're coming up with your answers, if you put them in the comments. If you're watching at a later time, or maybe you prefer not to engage in this way, that's fine, write them for yourself. This is an exercise we can all do at any point, not just now. So what do you know is true of God? Thank you for doing this exercise with me. Here are some things I came up with. He is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love. He does not treat us as our sins deserve. It's from Psalms 103. He's with you wherever you go, Joshua 1:9. He does not grow faint or weary, from Isaiah 40. He is close to the brokenhearted, Psalm 34. From Isaiah 43, he is the Lord, your Holy One, the Creator of Israel, your King. From Isaiah 44 and Revelation, he is the beginning and the end of everything, the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. And friends, we could go on and on and on and on about the things that we know are true of God. Even in our darkest days, we have a God who is always with us, who promises to carry us and never forget us. He is our Redeemer. So, as we face the suffering in our lives, we can, like Job, choose to hope. There is so much that we don't know, so much we can't see and may never understand. But hope in God, it's the surest thing we can count on. So the staff has asked us to close with a question, to present you with a question to ponder over this next week. And I couldn't get to just one question, so I'm leaving you with two. Where is God in this wilderness? And why does God allow darkness to cover our lives? So I'll be closing with a benediction here in a moment, but I also want to close with this quote from an animated movie. Recently, our family watched Wonder Park, and at the end of the movie, one of the characters says, "The darkness, it's still there." And another replies, "Maybe it'll never really fully go away. Maybe it's there to remind us to look at the light." The wind of the Spirit is blowing in the wilderness. As we are led further in, we walk in boldness as the Creator's beloved one. We walk in peace beside the footsteps of Jesus. We walk in grace, grounded in the loving words of God. Miss you all. Have a great week.